misfiring, maybe? The couple of spots you'd like to have back, I suppose. I think there's a spot that Flavian Pratt would like to have back. It's going to be very hard to avoid, and there's no reason to avoid, the conversation about the Haskell. A lot of moving parts, and made much more complicated needlessly by the eagerness to interject the crop rule into it, because the crop didn't have anything to do, crop or no crop, that was happening for 99 reasons, and the crop wasn't one of them. Take the crop discussion out of this. It had everything to do with the dynamics of racing, and I won't even say poor decision making, quote unquote. It you'll hear from Mig. Mig's going to be on at the top of the hour, and Tony Black later in the week. I've been hearing from Tony and exchanging some thoughts from him. I had Ramon Dominguez on TV yesterday on Loose on the Lead, and we visited it with Ramon, and Ramon actually had a particular, I mean, obviously any jock is going to have a particular understanding of what transpired in terms of coming over and you know, forging to a lead and, you know, not having enough clearance. And with Ramon yesterday on TV, I brought out a tape of the 2004 Breeders' Cup Turf, because Ramon had a very similar pair of brushes in the stretch, in mid-stretch and then late stretch, on Better Talk Now. In a very similar fashion. And so we looked at it. And Ramon also, if you saw the video clip I put up yesterday evening, afternoon, Ramon did some fancy video editing. He said he's got an app. And so he layered the head-on with the pan shot. And it's very good. And there's a bunch of things here you're going to hear that I think have not been as widely discussed. I tried to explain it on Twitter, but the eagerness to find fault with one individual and just pin it on him like a tail on a donkey, it's just such a fool's errand. There were all kinds of things happening there. Mandaloon is coming up and moving over three quarters of a path. And so, you know, Paco's kind of floating. Paco himself floated with Midnight Bourbon, floated Hot Rod Charlie a little bit as well. And you know, horses are naturally going to, their inclination is to head toward the rail and to head, you know, the head left in the stretch in that circumstance. And yes, Pratt didn't have full clearance, but at the same time, if you watch very carefully, and Richie will bear this out, both Rich and Ramon yesterday, and Tony too, all confirm Paco is pulling to the right himself, trying to more or less jump, not, you know, necessarily knowing that he was going to clip heels, but you see him moving himself to the right as Pratt is trying to clear. So he contributes to it too. This was a very complex race dynamic incident that was just unfortunate. What should be appreciated is that horse and riders come out of this, you know, relatively unscathed. Some bumps and bruises for Midnight Bourbon, and a little sore knee for Paco. Came back and rode Sunday. Frankly, you can feel badly for the Hot Rod Charlie connections and team and Doug O'Neill and that group, because, I mean, I certainly appreciate what Brad Cox had to say. Brad's actually flying right now, so we'll talk to him tomorrow. But as he said, you know, he said Mandaloon ran a winning race. I mean, the effort in its entirety was there. and you know, got beat to the wire and elevated. You know, sometimes horses get elevated and they were never winning. A very prominent jock agent made the suggestion, and he's not wrong, that if you adjudicated this 100 times with stewards, with maybe different sets of stewards and so forth, there would have been discussion in some stands about a double disqualification, because Mandaloon absolutely, watch the head on, Mandaloon absolutely is coming out, contributing to all this, you know, this crowding incident. So as I sort of tongue-in-cheek put out on Saturday, Flavian Pratt is now 1-for-1, 1-and-1, one win, one loss in high-profile crowding incidents. It's part of the game. But the whole cry, the immediately, you know, I understand why people would say, well, if he had the stick, he could have what? He could have nothing. he didn't, you know, the horse is traveling at 37 miles an hour, and you know, it's trying to Flavian at that point thinks he's pretty much clear, and he's going to try to confront Mandaloon. You know, the horses need to see each other to be engaged, and so this was just a race riding incident. It happens. Luckily, everybody comes out okay. That's the bottom line. It is interesting, though. There was a lot of interesting working parts. I'll put that when Rich joins us. I'll put that up again. Look on my feed for the video. It's really quite cool. All right, so that's my introduction to it. Completely understand and absolutely DQ was warranted, and you know, and placement, you know, behind the unplaced horse. So that's part of the life we've chosen. What else can you say? What else you can talk about, though, is all the activity from the spa to Oceanport to Oceanside. And at Del Mar opening day, the feature, the Oceanside, which was a really fun assembly to really kick off the action, you end up with Leonard Powell and Abel Cedillo with Flashiest, who I think I picked third, but was a nice price. And I was disappointed with What Makes Sammy Run. I thought this was, you know, kind of his, you know, next logical step toward, you know, toward things like Hollywood Derby, etc. You know, 3-year-old turf stardom. And from there, the weekend unfolded really nicely. Friday at Saratoga 2, how about the nice performance in the Forbidden Apple? Rinaldi, Jim Bond, Luis Saez, who's off to a rollicking start. Kieran McLaughlin and Luis Saez leading the jock standings. 10% of the meet under our belts. Handle's been nuts. Handle's been spectacular. Yeah, yesterday, obviously, off the turf, and the first of what'll be, you know, a handful of those, and you can't help that. Yesterday was kind of the, you know, your chance to exhale, I think, for the buy. I certainly, you know, after a kind of a harrowing morning, for those of you that were watching TV, you know that we were all worried about Seth. Seth was MIA yesterday morning, but he turned out fine. But it was a little unnerving, I got to tell you. But everything okay in the end. But otherwise, yesterday, after running down to New Jersey on Thursday after the show, opening day at Saratoga, and speaking of which, opening day at Saratoga, we will open the coverage in about 10 minutes with Norm Cassie. Norm! Pretty Birdie's win. I mean, I mentioned it in passing, obviously, along with Golden Pal's win in the quick call, first stake of the season. But what a, you know, I got a chance to talk about it, and we'll flesh it out with Norm. But opening day at Saratoga, and to have Mary Lou essentially be there, you know, in everyone's hearts and minds, that was pretty cool. So we'll talk to Norm Cassie to kick things off when it comes to, you know, the first, you know, the first weekend, first few days here of the opening salvos of the Saratoga season. The Saturday action between New Jersey and Saratoga. Charlie Appleby. Yeesh. those two Phillies, take them home and don't bring them back. I'm just kidding. But Althea and Summer Romance, 1-2, Appleby. What can you say? What can you say? And the two of them were well clear of everybody else. These two are frightening. Althea by Dark Angel and Summer Romance by Kingman. The Godolphin pair, one in the blue cap, one in the white cap. And it was Althea. Manny Franco gets his chance and makes good. 14th grade one win. Smith had ridden Althea to the Just a Game win. I think we all, you know, we talked about it enough. It just felt like maybe Summer Romance had a slightly better pace scenario in this spot. And it's just clear after these two, they didn't necessarily need to come, you know, to North America to prove it, but it does turn out that it seems like Althea, obviously, at this point, is the better of the two Phillies. Beaten her twice, and beaten her with two very different, distinct pace scenarios. I mean, in the Just a Game, you know, 46 and 4 half, 110 and 2, 3 quarters, and then in the Diana, 48 flat, 111 and 4. Now, of course, it's a mile and an eighth, but still, that was a very even, was a very acceptable even pace scenario, and Summer Romance just could not turn her back, period. But Godolphin, not all the news great for Godolphin, though, by the way, over the last few days. If you didn't see this, Mystic Guide sidelined with a knee chip. Is going to have it out. And they'll make a determination later. I mean, typically, they say it's nothing. Not when I say nothing. You know, you never want to go poking around in a top-quality horse's knee or ankle. But they say it's in a good spot. Dr. Bramlage is going to do it. And they're very confident that if they decide to keep going with him, that you know, there won't be anything in there, you know, damage wise. So there's an uncertainty about Mystic Guide going forward. They still got Maxfield. I mean, it's not like they're bereft and without options, right? So in addition to Althea in the Diana, how about the two-year-old Wit giving Practical Joke his first graded stake winner? IRAD aboard. Pletcher, and we'll talk to Todd tomorrow. He's tied up today, so we'll get to Todd. And you know what this horse has been doing? Got 90 buyer, by the way. What Wit has done here in these two performances, and 6-5 ended up looking pretty good, as it turned out. This is the $575,000 Rapoli Viola Gainesway colt and a May foal, FYI. So he's doing this, you know, despite giving away some maturity and some age to his foals. Was his foes was a May 5th foal, and 2 for 2. And poor starts, or at least slow starts. I don't want to call them poor, but slow starts. Both of his performances so far, and this was a, you know, this was a significant jump forward. And yeah, there's no reason to think this colt's not going to stretch out with a plum. So, Wit, part of a very good Saturday for Todd Pletcher and his team, because back at Monmouth, Joel Rosario was putting on a display, and before the crop conversations turned to the DQ and the Haskell situation, the crop discussion was focused, and I actually made a point myself about Joel Rosario. And Rosario, you know, midway through the card, had won 3 stakes. Won the Molly pitcher, obviously, with Graceful Princess, and that was the one that might have been most impressive. And boy, I gotta say, I was kicking myself about this. I lingered and lingered, and I looked, and I thought, why is, you know, here's Rosario getting back aboard, and, you know, he'd ridden her a couple of times, and you know, really had not made much impact last winter in the Gopher Wand and in an allowance race at Saratoga, and yet Ron Anderson, you know, sees fit to take the call, the point I made on Saturday was that Rosario is already a rider who rarely uses the crop. He's a hands and legs, arms, hands, legs rider. And under that circumstance, very tough. Wins the matchmaker for Chad on Great Island. Wins on Graceful Princess, the Molly Pitcher, and wins with Dr. Post. I can't get Dr. Post right no matter what I do. I think I even mentioned the other day when we were talking with Marcus. I liked him earlier in the year, and then he disappointed, and I've gotten him wrong over and over again. Very nice sequence for Joel. Tribhuvan, Flavian Pratt, and the United Nations for Chad. I'm looking forward to talking to Chad, actually, about, well, not today, but this is an interesting horse, this Tribhuvan. And Arklow was a no-show. No, I mean, barely got a call. Barely got a call. I'm sure you saw my write-up. I said too many people are picking Fantasioso. Too many people are picking him for him to win. And sure enough, it really did not impact it either. In the Wolf Hill, Critical Way for Jose Delgado with Paco. That was the stakes action. The rest of the card was good. And yesterday, the Jersey Girl, actually, I got to mention, because Hope Jones, the Haskell sisters. You can't have Haskell weekend without a Haskell sister. And sure enough, Hope Jones, groovy surprise, homebred of hers, Rory Houston and Manny Sanchez won that Jersey Girl yesterday. So congratulations to Hope. That was like a little perfect coda to Haskell weekend. Great time down there on Friday. What a fun morning we had. Thank Hammer again for coming out. Thank Frank again for coming out too and spending that what ended up being a rollicking 45 minutes. That was tremendous. And of course the news break, breaking news, the news about Frankie DeLuca's opening in Versailles, that it has gotten a huge response. Pretty funny. they're excited. So really fun time down at Monmouth. And after the show later, Friday evening, of course, it was Tina's birthday weekend down there. Went to Semolina Thursday night in Red Bank, which was fabulous. But got to thank Lou and Fran Raffetto, who they've got one of those nice pontoon cocktail boats, and we took us out on the Navisink. I've now cruised the Navisink, and I've bet on Navisink River as well. We had so much fun. John Parada and Maggie together, and Hammer, and oh my God, I'm going to forget the woman's name. She worked down at MJC. Ugh, I'm embarrassed. I'll get her name because I don't want to leave her out. We had the nicest, it was literally a 3-hour cruise. It was like Gilligan's Island and the Minnow. we had a, just tremendous. I'll get back to the whole weekend and everything that went on. But right now, let's go back to the start of Saratoga season and Thursday. And, you know, one of those magical kind of moments at the spa with Mary Lou Whitney looking down and Norm Cassie sends out Pretty Birdie to the Schuylerville win. Norm joins us. Congratulations.
Thanks, Steve. And sounded like you had a pretty fun weekend as well. It was a good weekend for a lot of people.
I no doubt. And the West Coast and down at Oceanport and really everywhere. I mean, everywhere I looked. We'll try to get it all in here in the coming days. But to absorb what went on opening day, particularly Norm, even before the stake, what was your impression of what felt like just a delirious 27,000 around the racetrack? It was like people hugging each other that they didn't even know.
Well, I mean. You can feel there's just it's a buzz. I think what one of the things that COVID kind of really did was made a lot of us realize all the awesome things that we took for granted. And, you know, Saratoga can be a little bit of a pain year in, year out. But then when you miss it and you miss that atmosphere one year, you realize how much you loved it. As much as you hate it sometimes, you realize how much you love it and how much you need it. And I don't know. I hope we all continue to remember the stuff that we took for granted and we don't do it again.
Well, that certainly in this part of the country, we're in a position. In fact, this came up yesterday, came up with Dave O'Rourke on Thursday when he sat with me, and then yesterday he was with me and Seth on TV. And, we feel very fortunate here. And, the fact that we can all operate under what feels like, normal conditions. Well, when it comes to normal place on the racing calendar, the Schuylerville is always there as the opening day feature, and talk about preparations with Pretty Birdie.
Yeah, Steve, I was caught between a rock and a hard place because we'll preface it with saying it all worked out. So I'm very happy with, obviously, with the outcome. But with Churchill closing for the turf renovations, my hands were a little bit tied. I think I would have, some of the things I learned from working with my father over the years is that we'd get the horses up to Saratoga, we'd breeze them once or twice before they'd run, and I think just the change of the racetrack and the surface would kind of beat them up, and they would get body sore, and they wouldn't run their best races. So ideally, I would have kept Pretty Birdie at Churchill at our home base, did all the major preparations leading into the Schuylerville there, and then shipped her in right on top of the race. But unfortunately, we weren't able to do that. So basically, Steve, I just took it really, really easy with her. We got her up there. We didn't do a whole lot. And I just said to myself, listen, if she's good enough, she's good enough. And we're not going to overthink this too much. And like I said, fortunately, it all worked out.
Well, went to the front, and Louis Saez is so good in this kind of a setting. Joe Talamo rode her in the debut win, and in terms of the approach and having to break from the rail, you're pretty much given a cue and given a template for how to approach the race. I mean, what were your thoughts going in?
Just that I was I want to say, you know, give Joe a lot of credit because he kind of set the foundation for her. She ran the same race under Joe as she did for Louie, which the 2-year-olds is, I like them to be aggressive. I like them to be to break sharp and be on the bridle and be right up there for multiple reasons. But, you know, obviously when we drew the one hole, it was like, oh, I guess we're gonna have to do this the hard way and just send the entire way. And fortunately, she broke sharp. I had the right man in the irons for her because Louie's so aggressive and he's so good leaving the gate that, you know, it all worked out.
Not to include being relieved or understanding that the assignment was made a little bit easier with Wesley having to scratch Happy Soul, but had Happy Soul been in the race, how would that have changed your thinking?
I don't think it would have changed anything. I think if she would have broke better than us and got out in front of us, we would have just shifted outside of her and given Pretty Birdie, you know, a target to run at. And truthfully, I think Pretty Birdie probably would have ran better than she did when she won, because it's my opinion that she got to, you know, lugging in down the lane and looking around and not switching leads just because she was kind of bored of what she was doing. If all the pictures that I've seen of her at the wire, her ears are straightforward. She's not all out. She's just out there having fun, playing around. And had she had a horse to run down, I think she would have ran a much more professional race, in my opinion.
From what you see of her in the morning, I mean, obviously the hand was somewhat forced in this situation, as we discussed, being on the inside, and, you know, with the other major speed having come out of the race. When you watch her and when, you know, you work with her in the mornings, do you get the sense that, you know, that as the distances stretch out, and I'm going to guess that off of this, you'll think about the end of the meet rather than the Adirondack, but watching her, talk about her potential to stretch out, because she's certainly bred for two turns.
She's, to me, Steve, like the prototypical legit good horse. She's very, very fast. She can go to the front end and be comfortable, but more importantly than that is the way she gallops and the way she does everything in the morning is professional. She's kind. She's rateable. She's push button. So we ask her to go leaving the gate going 3/4 or 5/8 or whatever, she's going to go. But if we want to sit back and sit off a horse, she's going to do that. And, you know, ultimately, that's what makes a good route horse. You have to, I believe a legitimate route horse will have early speed, but once they get to the position that they want to be in early on in the race, they have to shut off at some point. And, you know, unfortunately, there's a lot of horses that just, you can't, you know, you try your best to teach them that, but they just don't learn their lessons. Pretty Birdie, I'm fairly confident, it's going to, every time we do something, she's going to do exactly what we want her to do.
Well, that's a nice, certainly a nice position to be in. There's actually a full brother to Pretty Birdie that's on the ground from this spring. So there's another one coming. She missed. She slipped between 2019 and 2021, and there is actually a winless sister, a half by Carpe Diem, Midsummer Bird, and you know, with John Hendrickson going on with it, talk a little bit about the reaction, you know, at Saratoga to, you know, the baby blue and brown in the winner's circle on opening day.
Just excitement beyond belief. Like, they just, you said it best when you started the segment. You know, it was one of those bigger bigger than horse racing moments, not to sound really cliche or corny, but it was magical. Like, it's poetic. It's everything that you would imagine. I tell you, Steve, I've been a part of a lot of big races with my dad, and then now going forward in my career. I have never, and I say this with all sincerity, I have never been that nervous for a race. Because I felt like we were going to win. When I found out that Happy Soul had scratched, I just got this pit in my stomach. Because then it was like, I thought we were going to win. Now we have to win. It's different. But it was just because I'm just with the way that the track had just opened up to the fans. They had done this really beautiful segment on Mary Lou. John, Mary Lou is awesome, but John has carried on her legacy. Like, I can't even describe everything that he does, and he deserved that moment. So I just put a lot of pressure on myself, and luckily, Pretty Birdie did exactly what I thought she was going to do. But I promise you, Steve, I have never been so nervous for a race in my life.
That's great. That includes some big moments for Tepin, who you basically were handling, on a day by day basis.
Yeah, oh, Tepin and Classic Empire and World Approval, like those were just like, I don't know how to describe it. Like Tepin, she had done so much for all of us that if she lost, like, okay, we can't be upset. Classic Empire, when he ran in the Derby, it was just a miracle to have gotten him there, right? So, like, to me, we were playing on house money. This was just so different. Like, and I'm sure, as I say this now, like, if we're fortunate enough and she does make it to the spinaway at the end of the meet, I'm going to be just as nervous that day, too. What a way to close the meet out. So, right. Yeah, it's just a real moment. I've tried to figure out. I've had plenty of opportunities to get interviewed about it. There's no real way to describe it or do it justice, but it was just it was a really cool and magical thing to be a part of.
Well, and I'll probably do this. I'm going to guess with Sid on Wednesday, but one of the sidebars to this story and to this horse is, I believe it's at least 8 generations of Whitney breeding involved.
Yeah, and I tell you, when she broke her maiden, I've never heard John be so happy. Just when she broke her maiden, like he actually texted Gabby and I in a group text and said, you know, how happy we just made him, this and that. And it's a Mary Lou through and through. And it's like, that's a throwback. That doesn't happen anymore.
No, very few.
And what was really funny about all of it, though, Steve, is like, so I've worked really hard trying to get John to start buying some babies, and he actually has one of them that we purchased for him at OBS March. He's in on Friday. He's going to be the heavy favorite in the first race on Friday. But he went out and bought 3 2-year-olds this year, 2 with me, 1 with Ian, and it's the first time he's done it in years. But Pretty Birdie breaks her maiden, and I answer the phone when he calls me, basically in the winner circle, and he goes, "See, I told you I don't have to buy any." So I'm like, oh, man. But he has a point. He doesn't have to. That's pretty cool training for these guys.
Just to give everybody a feel, and bear with me on this, Bird Sense, by Street Sense, and trained by Ian Wilkes, out of Bird Harbor, by Boston Harbor. Bird Harbor was trained by Ronaldo Abreu, who got horses, had been Nick's assistant and got horses when he went out on his own. Mary Lou, helped him get started. Bird Harbor, 2-time winner, out of Dearest Gulch, and Dearest Gulch, Tom Amos actually trained. And that was a Whitney bred that was campaigned by Parrish Hill and then came back into the fold from the broodmare side. Then going a step further back out of the wonderful Dear Birdie that was trained by Lynn Whiting. This was a Stormbird and goes all the way back to Hush Deer, who was a $500,000 winner for Elliot Birch, and C.V. Whitney that won, she won the Diana a couple of times and the Long Island and so forth. So, I mean, this has got just layer upon layer of C.V. and Mary Lou involved, and it's one of the great, one of the truly great legacy families and operations in the game. So you've contributed to history, Norm. You've done it other times, but this is this is new and under your name.
Yeah, Steve, it's it's a pretty amazing feeling to be a part of something like that, to be honest, and just to have my name associated with Mary Lou Whitney Staples is, I mean, that's a gift that, I'll never be able to repay. I just appreciate that they've done that for me.
Well, so the spin away, 7 furlongs and 6+ weeks to prepare for that makes perfect sense. You mentioned what's coming up. Let's spend a couple of minutes talking about how your position for the rest of the meet and Buckingham Prince, the Maiden, and American Tattoo, too, on Friday.
Yeah, well, American Tattoo probably won't get in. He's a main track only, and that's a pretty salty race. So we'll have to look at that one really hard to decide if we want to run if it does come off. Buckingham Prince is the only horse in there that started. He probably should have won the race at Ellis. He got loose on the lead, and I think Joe kind of got overconfident that he was going to win, and we got nailed right on the wire. It came back a pretty quick two-year-old race, and obviously I was upset at the moment, and then I realized, hey, this horse is eligible for one of those maiden auction races at Saratoga. How cool would it be to have this horse up in Saratoga and win for Mary Lou up there? So I'm a little bit apprehensive because he is coming back quick. But with all that being said, he should be pretty tough to beat on Friday in the first race. As far as the rest of the summer goes, it's just a bunch of babies that I think probably are going to need a race. So we won't get too much into those. I do have two really nice babies that have actually started in stakes and ran really well on the ones and twos, Broker Maiden at Churchill, and then finished second after a tough trip in the debutante. She's going to run in the Adirondack, and Glacial, Robert Masterson colt. I say that again. It's a colt. He let me buy a colt for him. He just finished third in the Bashford Manor, and he had a kind of a tough trip. Both of them worked yesterday morning, and they're being pointed to the Adirondack and the Saratoga Special, respectively.
Very nice. How many do you have here?
We have 16. We have 16 there, and then we have 16 at Ellis for the summer.
Nice, nice.
So I'm actually back in Kentucky today for a few days, going to check on the Ellis division and then go back up.
Excellent. Well, and, speaking of buying yearlings or, there'll be some weanlings later in November. Talk about your perspective, weanling.
okay, yeah, we got Gabby and I have a colt on the way. She's due naturally on Breeders' Cup Day. So if we're fortunate enough that Pretty Birdie goes and takes us to that position, I'm going to have some difficult decisions to make on a personal level. But hopefully we get to that point where we have to make those decisions. But yeah, we're very excited. It's our first child, and for Dad, it's his first grandson. My brother has two daughters, but I really think Dad is super excited about the prospect of Gabby and I having a son. So, we've worked together. Me and Dad worked together in a lot of ways and to help each other win some big things. I think this is probably the thing he's most proud of that I've done so far.
I love it. And I tell you, given the equine heritage on both sides, I suppose the naming discussions have been a challenge. What some pushing and pulling going on in the?
When Gabby and I have decided, we already know the name of him, and but we're not going to reveal that right now.
Okay.
Our close friends and family know, but it's one of those deals, Steve, where you learn, when you start throwing names out at people, and they almost grimace when you say their name. It's like you don't need people's opinions when you're naming. You know, once the baby's named, they can't have that reaction. They just have to be like, "Oh, what a wonderful name!" But when you're throwing out names for a potential child, everybody's got to be like a critic. So we're going to keep it a secret, we're thrilled. So we're very, very happy.
Well, and luckily, you don't have to submit it to the Jockey Club for approval.
It's difficult. Yeah, they'd probably find something wrong with it.
I love it. I love it. And you know, it's funny because none of my own, but we've got the granddaughter, and our, you know, observations on this topic, very similar to your experience, because Zachary and Andrea, they started to float names for she ended up being called Lennon, and there was tremendous carrying on resistance, and not to Lennon, but to the original names they were floating. And so now with they're going to have a boy in October, actually right around the same time. I think Andrea's due on Halloween, I think on the 31st.
Wow.
So very close. And they're doing the same thing this time. They're not revealing anything to anybody. And everybody's going to like
it. Yeah. Well, but I'm just saying, and sometimes it's like, so my stepbrother and his wife had a daughter a few years ago. First of all, they didn't even find out the sex of the baby till that day. Like, they waited, and they didn't reveal it. They had a name for a boy and a girl, but they didn't reveal
it
until it came out. Yeah, and her name is Carden, and I remember thinking, right when they said the name, I was like, oh, I don't necessarily like the name. And I love the name now. Like, it fits her. You know what I mean? And it's like,
yeah.
But had they thrown that name out to people, that may not be that girl's name right now. You know? And I just think that's where Gabby and I realized, like, just go with what you like, and don't worry about what everybody else, and it'll suit it. So, but I digress. We're getting into baby naming and stuff on a horse racing show. I like the name Pretty Birdie really good.
That's your favorite. That's your favorite name. Well, it's too bad. It's not going to be a girl, but maybe next time, because then Birdie's a cute nickname. So
very good. You're right.
Norm Cassie, congratulations to you, John Hendrickson, Louie, everybody involved. A great way to start the meet. And, it lifts everybody's spirits and, you know, makes everything that comes, good and bad from it, makes it easy to take. So good luck at Ellis. Good luck. We'll see you probably later this week.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me on. And keep doing what you're doing, Steve. We all appreciate what you do for us.
My pleasure, and it's fun conversations like this that make it so easy and so pleasant. Norm Cassie, everybody, and Gabby Gaudette, of course. Follow Norm at Norm Cassie, just nice and simple, and of course named after his own grandfather, famously. One thing I didn't get to mention in the opening moments of the show and opening monologue, the day one. Opening day this Monday, today, at Colonial. And we'll talk to Jill Byrne later, but I'm not going to miss a chance to kick off the season and get a meet advance with Jason Beam. He joins us now. Jason, good morning, and best of luck for the Colonial season.
I appreciate it, Steve. It's good to talk to you. How are you?
Excellent, excellent, and you've been on, you know, your typical gallivant. There's always a fun fun follow and fun travels wherever you're headed, and that included the June 30, July 1 trip to get comfortable at Tampa. How was that?
It was good. I was really, really glad to have those 2 days just to kind of dip a toe. And you know, the angles are way different. It's a very low booth there in Tampa, and so just getting to meet everybody and do all that, it was very fortuitous, kind of the timing of how that all worked out, because I feel much more just comfortable kind of knowing what to expect when November rolls around.
Exactly, exactly. And what about, did you get to look around for a place to live?
Yeah, I had to do my podcast and a bunch of other stuff during the early part of the week, but I had all of Friday and Saturday after the races to kind of drive around. And, you know, Margo was saying a lot of the horse people obviously live kind of right around the track, but, you know, with me, I only got to be there race days and not till, you know, 10 o'clock, 10:30. So I was kind of looking more at Clearwater and Dunedin as possible options, but we'll see.
Well, you're going to love it, and absolute acclamation with the news that you were going to follow Richard Grunder after his long and really a beloved stint at the mic.
Yeah, I told everybody down there, because a couple people were saying, you know, it's going to be a little unusual. I said, yeah, it's going to be weird for a little while. I mean, it's just, I was 3 when he started there, so, you know, I certainly never have known another voice there, and I'm sure most people haven't. So, it's always, anytime I think a new announcer goes to a new track, it just takes a little while to acclimate and get, just kind of get used to it.
No doubt. Well, and of course, last year when you were hoping to, have inaugural season at Colonial, the situation that kind of pressed and pulled from every single direction kind of conspired against the meet. I'll talk with Jill Byrne quite a bit about that, but all systems go to kick off for this week, and boy, anybody looking at the PPs, looking at these gigantic full fields, everybody says how much they love turf racing. Well, you can prove it here at Colonial, what looks to be a spectacular start here these next 3 days.
Oh, man, the opening day card. I kind of had a sense. I was in the race office first thing last Wednesday morning when they were doing entries. I was just doing some video stuff. And, the first half hour, the phones were just nonstop, and a few agents were in there. And, I kind of was expecting this because of the Churchill backside closing, where there's some new connections and all that. But, five 14 horse fields on a 9-race flat card. We certainly don't want to forget about the jump races going before, even though they're non-wagering events. So, and even one of those has a full field.
Well, and in fact, it's a big week for the Chasers, because we've got the Kaiser here on Wednesday and the Smithwick on Thursday. We'll talk to Bill Gallo about that and Colonial Course Incorporating. It's such a great environment, Virginia at large, such a strong hotbed for the Chasers and Timber Racers, and the two races, I think most people in the PPs are appearing at the end, but they're actually going to be the first two races of the day.
Yeah, races 10 and 11 are before race 1, which is a little bit confusing, but they're not betting of races, but they're streamed, I believe, is how they're actually being shown and stuff. And so, for me, it's similar to the Tampa thing. Like, I kind of like it because I get two races to kind of get warmed up and get back into it before the thoroughbred betting broadcast starts.
Well, that starts at 1:45 Eastern, and nine races today, including the stakes. We'll talk about them in a minute. But for your part in this, Jason, I mean, talk about Colonial in general, and having this summer assignment, and really your calendar has kind of now filled in, it seems. I mean, we'll talk about Grants Pass as well in a second, but with this meet and with Tampa, you pretty much are almost a year-round announcer now.
Yeah, the schedule is almost too perfect. I mean, I kind of have about a two-week break after each little leg of it. The only interference I have at all is the couple days of Tampa interfere with the last week or so at Grants Pass in the spring, but the Grants Pass folks were really cool to let me go down and do it this year, and I have nothing but amazing things to say about them, and I'm sure you saw the article in the Times this morning kind of showcasing little Grants Pass, so it was pretty cool. But the schedule's just too perfect almost right now, and Colonial was actually the first track to hire me full-time, in the last several years, because I was doing the Monmouth fill-in, and Jill called about doing this, so I certainly have a little extra loyalty to them for making me their guy, and not just a fill-in.
Well, there are some unique challenges to having this kind of card assembled, and you actually shared last night when I was reaching out to you to line you up to visit this morning. You showed me in no uncertain terms what one of those challenges is, and that is doing the silk coloration on the programs so that at a glance, you can make the association. But 14 by 14 by 11 by 7 by 14 by 14 by 10 by 14 by 13 in the thoroughbred action today. I mean, it's just nuts, and keeping track of that many horses, not easy, and that includes in some turf sprints, Jason. How do you run through 14 horses in 56 seconds?
I was telling our wonderful analyst Jessica Paquette last night, the second race, I think, is 5-furlong, 2-year-olds, 14 of them. And with those races, I found the hardest part of them, which is weird to say, is once you get through them all, usually when you come back to the leaders, it's kind of as they're turning for home, which is always the trickiest time to see them, because the jocks are behind the horse's head, and you don't see the silks as well, you don't see the saddle talons. So I'm going to try to really, really blast through them the first time around so I can pick them up at about the 5/16. That way I can kind of paint a picture coming into the stretch of who was where, and not, sitting there looking for any little color flash to tell me who it is.
Well, and just looking down at that race, a 4-1 favorite for Brittany Russell, Thunder Boss, with husband Sheldon in the irons, but a lot of ways. I mean, at 2-year-olds, you got pedigree work to do, and that one, I just glanced at the field. I didn't do any hard work at all. The stakes, though, let's talk about the four stakes that kickoff opening day, and at 2:41, the third race, the Nellie Cox first stake.
Yeah, the one thing I've got to remind people is the Virginia bred program, it incorporates a few different avenues in terms of,
yes,
there's sires, they're certified, which means they kind of lived here for a portion of their life, and it was basically so they could keep the breeding program active. But clearly there was a lot of horses that partook in it. But the stakes races are going to be interesting. I don't have the PPs in front of me, Steve, so I'm going to cop out a little bit on that. Actually, I had this conversation with somebody else the other day. They said, how much handicapping do you do for races you call? And I kind of try not to do too much. I just don't want to have too many ideas in my head. No, I just want to report kind of what's going on. I mean, certainly you want to know if somebody's, coming into the race hot, if somebody's, coming in with a win streak or stuff like that. But I always leave it to the analysts to do the heavy lifting on the handicapping stuff.
Well, there's enough, with fields this big in terms of name recognition and memorization and adding in the jackets some pronunciations. And in fact, I've got to ask this, looking at this Nellie Mae Cox. there's a word for those that either own or breed horses and name horses. It's funny, we're talking about naming babies with Norm Cassie. When it comes to naming horses, I think a lot of people, myself included, I've for years have kept a list. If I see a name, a word that I think or you know, anything, sometimes a concept that might make for a good horse name, I keep a list of them. And a horse shows up in this race that I didn't realize the name had been given out. But Petrichor in yeah. this Nellie Mae Cox. And did you look up what that means? Yes.
No, I didn't look up the definition. I did watch some replays of Dave Rodman calling the horse just to double check on the pronunciation. But I would love an education if you have one.
Petrichor is one of these bizarre words that is actually a description of a sense of something. In this case, it's the smell after a spring or summer rain. That's what's so amazing about it is that it's a word that describes something really, you know, amorphic, something that's undefinable. When I first discovered it, I don't know how long ago, I went right on my list of horse names. So congratulations to Pathfinder Racing for utilizing it as a horse name.
I feel like that's something Michael Rona would throw in a call, like they run down the backstretch post Petrichor, and, you know, that's something he would throw in there.
Well done. In addition to the Cox that goes as the third, the Burt Allen goes as the fourth. Are the state breds going a mile and a 16th on the inner side of the turf course, the gigantic turf course? You got the Meadow Stable, another turf sprint on the card, going as the fifth. Then you've got an allowance or two, right? You got two allowances.
Yeah. The seventh. The Gilpin goes as the feature later.
Exactly, the Gilpin, the $100,000 Tyson Gilpin, fillies and mares, one more turf sprint. So, for those, and I'm certainly going to put out a big good luck to our friend Woodbury Payne and Olga and Sally Thomas. Momentous miss in here, the Cantheros filly for them, and would love for Woodbury to knock out a win in the Gilpin today.
If I remember right, the Gilpin winner from 2019 is making their return start in this race. I'm trying to remember who it was, but I thought it was an interesting pepino.
Well,
the horse won the 2019 edition and then is off for 2 years and comes back in this race.
Pretty funny, and I'm going to turn back to the, let's see. No, where is this?
Maybe it's another Steve. I looked at a lot of people.
Yeah, exactly. When you got all these 14 horse fields, it's not the Gilpin, but you do have
maybe. Maybe.
This is a nice group.
Yeah, like I said, I looked at way too many horses this weekend.
One thing that, and you mentioned Jessica Paquette, who's going to be doing the paddock work and some of the handicapping conversations. There's a real challenge, Jason, in this, given where horses are coming from. And here's a perfect example. You know, looking at this Gilpin, this is where horses have made their last starts: Pimlico, Indiana, Mountaineer. Some more Pimlico, Monmouth, Keeneland, Belmont, Charlestown, another Indiana, Tampa, another Charlestown, and another Mountaineer. So, I mean, there's horses coming from all over, and this is a stake, but looking at the rank and file racing, you know, there's horses coming down from New York, they're coming from the Mid-Atlantic, obviously, really from, they're coming up from Florida. So this is going to be a challenge for everybody, whether it's you on the mic or Jessica handicapping, and for those of us playing at home and far and wide.
Yeah, I was talking to with Jess about the fact that the first year, you know, we kept trying to find any kind of real patterns on the turf course in terms of bias or things like that. And Irv and I, who was the analyst back then, like, we just never truly came up with what looked to be a repetitive pattern in any way. The dirt course had a real inside flow for the, you know, for a few weeks, and we should see a little more dirt racing there this year because of, you know, not having to use the lights. We can now run on the dirt more, and so they always say they're gonna, but the turf race is built so much it's hard not to use them. So
exactly.
Yeah, so it's gonna be interesting to see how that plays, because I think our dirt races are amazing, and it's, you know, it's, other than Belmont, it's the biggest dirt track, so it's a little unique at a mile and a quarter, and it's just, I just think they produce fun races.
Well, it's also, for those that have never been out to New Kent, I mean, and it is, you know, one of the challenges has always been getting people to, you know, to make the trip. It's kind of out and away from things, and east of Richmond. But it is a, you know, it's a absolutely glorious setting.
Yeah, it's very, very pastoral. One thing I like is the booth is so high, I'm kind of above the trees, and so you really get an expansive view from upstairs. And, you know, when the thunderstorms are coming in, you can see them coming in from dozens of miles away. It's a neat perspective, because both Tampa and Grants Pass have very low booths, so I don't kind of get that grand aesthetic in that sense.
Will you be cataloging the insect population of Central Virginia for everybody?
I'll never forget, Steve, the first night at Colonial. Like, it's like the seventh or, you know, nerves are finally calming down. I'm almost through day one. And there was a bug that looked like one of those huge tiger shrimp you see on a sushi plate that was crawling up my window. And, you know, for being from Seattle, we just don't have that kind of stuff. And so I called Jill, and I was like, is this, you know, am I going to be okay, or do I need to call my mom and kind of give her my, you know, my last best wishes kind of thing?
I love it. I love it when once you do that, other announcers follow with their pictures of what they've cataloged, and then there's pictures, the pictures of the hawk at Belmont, you know, right next to the sixth floor and so forth. I love it. Jason, it should be a tremendous meet. We'll talk more next hour at 11 with Jill Byrne as well. I don't want to end this on a difficult note, but given your familiarity with the region and having, you know, the Grants Pass meet, the news that you helped circulate of the passing of Eduardo Gutierrez Sosa at Crooked River, the quarter horse racing, and I'd love for you to just pay tribute to him.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. I mentioned that article in the New York Times that came out this morning about Grants Pass, and the header picture shows Eduardo on the lead, and the way you know that is he always wore pink jock pants, and somebody had told me that he had done something to get it approved to where he could wear those, and I never found out if it was a cause close to his heart or what, but it, they also went with his wife, Silks. His wife, Rosa, was a trainer, and it was actually her horse that he was riding when he was killed. So, I mean, it's so sad. He was a very sweet guy. You know, the people at Grants Pass and the Oregon Horsemen in general, I mean, they're a hardworking group. There's not a ton of money in it. You know, it's very much their entire life, like it is for a lot of horsemen everywhere. But, you know, Eduardo started in 2013, I believe it was, and he was at Portland my last couple years there. I never got to meet him down there, but got to meet him several times at Grants Pass along with Rosa. You know, they have young kids, and the whole thing is just, it's so, you know, remarkably sad. I talked to everybody from the track the other day, and, you know, he was just a really good part of the jocks room, a consistent part of that backstretch. And like I said, I mean, they, you know, that was a family business for them, and he obviously was a major, major part of that.
Well, I appreciate it, Jason. I'm sure I sprung that on you. Didn't bring it up, but I knew you'd relish a chance to, you know, to pay tribute. As I reminded people on Twitter, since World War II, an average of two riders a year are killed in action, and given how much happiness and excitement there was Thursday, Friday, Saturday, it's a reminder that, you know, this is a dangerous enterprise for horse and rider, and for those that care for the horses, and everybody, you know, is as vigilant as can be. But even, you know, even the most professional around a horse is sort of at you know, at the mercy of luck and happenstance. Very, very tough to read all the tributes that came in. So I wanted people to be aware. Jason, meanwhile, you got to be excited about the action starting at Colonial early today, this afternoon, and we'll be watching. We'll check in over the summer as well. I appreciate the opportunity to kick off the Colonial season with you.
Always an honor to be invited on your show, Steve. I really appreciate it.
Jason Beam, everybody. Beamy Awards on your Twitter, and Jason will guide everybody through, as well as Jessica and Jill Byrne and everybody. Colonial Rosies and racing in Virginia back for a full season. Keep our fingers crossed that nothing interrupts it. Let's take a top-of-the-hour break. Now we're in already. Rich Migliore is going to join us next. We'll talk to Jill Byrne in hour three as well. Got some more horseman visits as well. Stay with us at the races. SiriusXM back after this.
With Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
The thoroughbred season at Colonial Downs is in full swing. The season continues through September 1st with racing every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday at 1:45 p.m. Closing week features the Grade 3 New Kent County Virginia Derby along with four other turf stakes on Tuesday, August 31st. It's our biggest day of the meet. Bet an all-stakes, all-turf pick 5 wager on Derby Day. Closing day, Wednesday, September 1st, features 5 stakes for Virginia bred and sired horses. Virginia Derby Day, August 31st, followed by Virginia bred stakes day the following afternoon. Post time both days at 1:45 p.m.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only 3 states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them, is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-9
Sirius XM Sports presents